Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Skyline studio is Susana Mendoza. She is the Democratic Comptroller for the state of Illinois. Madam Comptroller, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you. I think I was busy puking there. Sorry. Oh, my God. I seriously feel sick after hearing that.
It is interesting to see how some of these campaigns play out around the country.
How about, I don't even feel comfortable having the TV set on with my five-year-old in the house. I'm not kidding. It is, like, not something I want him to see or traits I want him to learn to emulate.
Well, you know, it's especially when you have wealthy candidates. And, I mean, let's face it, I remember I talked to one political scientist, and was asking them about some strategy that a candidate was using. And they said, well, if it was a regular funded candidate, you'd say, well, they're probably wasting money. Except when people have so much money, if it means switching one vote, is it a waste?
Right.
That's kind of the nature of our politics today. Well, I wanted to ask you about the Truth in Hiring Act. And I was trying to explain, this is something that we've seen from both parties for decades, of governors trying to, we call it offshoring now, I guess that's the term that works, but basically really hiding the costs of high staffers and attributing them to various state agencies, like the Department of Transportation or Health and Family Services, those kinds of things. And then you present your budget and you say, oh, well, look, I'm saving all this money from what my predecessor had, when in actuality, that's how, I mean, Pat Quinn was offshored.
He was
in the Dan Walker
administration. That's right, under Dan Walker.
Mm-hmm. He was in the Illinois Industrial Commission.
Mm-hmm. So, and he was a chronic offender of this deceptive practice when he was governor.
Yes. So, but the governor didn't necessarily want to sign this bill.
He did not necessarily. He did not want to sign this bill, but, you know, I'm glad he did. I think it was pretty evident that this bill had garnered widespread bipartisan support. As a matter of fact, it passed through the House of Representatives unanimously. And in the Senate, I think there were only like seven people that voted against it. So we would have, if he had not signed it, it would have become law on its own. But that would have been the first time in his tenure that he let something become law on its own without signing it, right?
So he was kind of taking action.
Yes, he was like in a pickle here. Does my bill become the first bill during his tenure to become law without his signature, right? Which would have been a whole different story.
Right.
Or does he veto it and then get overwhelmingly, hopefully unanimously, overridden on a veto like we did with the Debt Transparency Act? So I think he had people advising him to do the right thing, and I'm glad he did, and that we now have this practice come to an end here in Illinois, and future governors will not be able to continue to hide their true cost of their payroll from the public. I mean, taxpayers deserve to know how their money's being spent. And when governors present budgets, they should be honest budgets. And that goes for every other state constitutional officer. I mean, the governor kind of threw out this like fake example that, well, this should apply to all the other constitutional officers. But that's kind of like saying you're going to ticket, you're going to give people speeding tickets for jaywalking, right? Like the two don't go together. The other state constitutional officers do not do offshoring. And where there are intergovernmental agreements, they're on these levels which are equal. So, for example, if this attorney general wants to have lawyers that are being paid out of revenue, that's because they went into an intergovernmental agreement with the Department of Revenue, which is on equal footing. But when the governor, for example, takes employees, takes the payroll out of other employee agencies that he controls, that's like saying if he's your boss, Rick, that, hey, I'm going to take $150,000 out of your budget, and I hope you don't mind. But even if you do mind, there's absolutely nothing you can do because he's your boss, right? So the power dynamic and the power shift is not equal.
And this is one of several transparency bills that
yes.
you raised, and you touched on the debt transparency,
which he did veto. And, right. you know, we
Well, I was going to say, do you think that was a precursor for him to sign this was the fact
that he's already been through that, right? So, and that was such a monumental, it was really revolutionary bill when you think about budgeting in Illinois. And for the first time in the history of the state of Illinois this year, when they were crafting budgets, the legislature was working off of numbers that were current as of a month earlier versus a year earlier, which used to be the status quo prior to the Debt Transparency Act. So why anyone in the right mind would veto a bill that would allow legislators, the public, and certainly the person responsible for managing the state's bills to be able to have visibility of those bills is crazy, but he did. And thankfully, the legislature in unanimous fashion in the House, which, by the way, had never happened in the history of the state of Illinois, managed to override a governor's veto unanimously. So this is a good thing. Transparency is a hallmark of my administration. The governor and his address when he signed this in his statement said that transparency is a hallmark of his administration, but I think that would certainly, just based on the facts, only make sense on opposite day.
Well, the debt transparency, I thought, was a pretty significant only because everybody was basically doing guesstimates.
Right.
No one had actually any, only the agencies themselves knew how much their billing was that they were withholding from supplying to you for payment.
Yeah, to the controller's office, right.
And forcing the General Assembly, forcing comptrollers to try to do cash flow without knowing what next avalanche of bills is going to come falling
out of like
their head.
In the blind, it doesn't make any sense. And so, I mean, when I was in the legislature, I, along with all of my colleagues, we just assumed that the state's chief fiscal officer could see all of the liabilities that the state had incurred. And it wasn't until I took office as controller that I realized that that was far from the truth. And I could essentially, in any given day, maybe see half of all the liabilities, but I had to fly blind
on
everything else.
But you didn't know it was half.
I didn't even know it was half. Exactly. Now I know it was half based on the fact that we do have monthly reporting now with the Debt Transparency Act. But you're right. I was essentially flying blind that first, you know, year plus. And that's unacceptable. And it's not about me. It's about me doing the job that the taxpayers voted for me to do, which is to manage the state's fiscal accounts. And it's about taxpayers being able to know and have full faith and confidence as to how their money is being spent. And so this is what we're trying to do every day, is come up with initiatives that shine greater transparency on the state's finances. Because, as you know, there's a lot of things that have been happening that should not have been happening with the state's finances. And I believe that in order to clean it up, you have to shine some light on it. Because, as they say, sunshine or sunlight is a great disinfectant, right?
We're speaking with Susana Mendoza. She is the Democratic State Comptroller for the state of Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline studio with Democratic State Comptroller Susana Mendoza. We're talking about transparency legislation, and we're talking about the bill to prevent the offshoring of salaries in the governor's office, but there's actually a couple of bills that are still pending out there on the governor's desk.
Yeah, we're hoping he will sign those as well. So I'll tell you really quickly what they do. I have two more to go. We have the budgeting for interest payment, which you can call the Mendoza-McSweeney bill. So shout out to my pal Dave McSweeney. He was actually...
Maybe you guys should have just done the show today.
I know, right? That would have been fun.
Yeah.
He was actually the chief sponsor of the legislation in the House. And I don't know that you could ever point to a Democratic constitutional officer of any, you know, office who's actually sought out a Republican or a member of the opposite party to be the lead sponsor on a bill. But I'm really committed to working in a bipartisan fashion, and he did a wonderful job. He's known to be a fiscal hawk. And so Dave sponsored that for me in the House. It passed unanimously. And what it does is that it requires governors to include in their budget proposals their plans to pay down the state's late payment interest penalties. And many times people have heard me talk about this. Those penalties now total nearly $1 billion. And that's only because I've paid some of them down, by the way.
Right.
They've gone over $1 billion just in late payment interest penalties. So up to now, governors have had to make no mention, or actually they've made no mention of these liabilities in their budget proposals. But moving forward, they will have to account for them in their budgets, and they'll have to have a plan for paying them down. These are real liabilities that have been incurred.
Well, it's like you can't just, because it's not on the book,
exactly,
doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
I keep telling people, just because, you know, you're not talking about it doesn't mean it didn't happen. And so we have to pay these bills down. They're liabilities that taxpayers are on the hook for. And it's time that governors stop pretending that they didn't rack up these fees. Secondly, we have the vendor payment program transparency bill. And that would bring sunshine to the governor's program that allows lenders to upfront money to state vendors who are owed money by the state. So especially during the budget crisis, you know, a lot of these folks,
are these third party.
Yeah, the vendors themselves weren't getting paid for the services that they rendered the state. And because we weren't paying them as a state since there was no budget, they were allowed to utilize third-party lenders. But we don't know anything about who these third-party lenders are. And now we're talking about a program that is upwards of $1 billion. So it's time to shine some light on who's behind all of these deals. Like, who is the money flowing to? I think that people deserve to know. And there should be some serious requirements in terms of transparency as to who's profiting from essentially the state's dysfunction, right? So
these were like vendors that were selling their accounts receivables.
So the 12% late payment interest penalties that the actual vendors are eligible for, that is what is contracted out to the third-party lenders. So they stand to make over $1 billion in late payment interest penalties. But again, we don't know who it's going to.
Right.
We know that it was money that was originally owed to a legitimate vendor that contracted with the state.
And provided
services. But then they contracted with this third-party lender of whom we know almost nothing about. So I think it's important, again, to follow the money and just to be transparent about where taxpayer dollars are going to. So those bills also almost unanimously passed both chambers and are awaiting the governor's signature.
Where do we stand on our payment backlog these days?
Well, I think just today we might be around $7.3 billion. Remember, we were at $16.7 billion about a year ago. So I'm very excited that we've been able to, through smart money management and also really leading the charge on refinancing the state's backlog. If you recall, Rick, we put out $6 billion worth of bonds to pay down that $16.7 billion, and we were able to refinance $6 billion of that at 3.5% instead of the 12% that we were paying. So that saved taxpayers $4 to $6 billion. And today, actually, I just looked up the number, and it's $7.6 billion. And it fluctuates anywhere between 6.5 to 8.5, just based on what payments I have to make. Like, if I'm putting education payments out, you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, out, right?
Medicaid payments. I have to kind of wait to accrue the money that I need to make a big, huge payment. But essentially, that bill backlog is staying somewhat steady. The only difference to that is that now that we have a budget in place, you might remember that the governor and the legislature had to include a supplemental appropriation for Department of Corrections.
Right.
That was almost $500 million. Just because they appropriated doesn't mean that they have the revenues to pay for those. So the bill backlog will likely be going up, you know, anywhere from probably $800 million to $1 billion because of additional appropriations that the legislature and the governor approved without new revenue streams to pay for them. But I have it under control, and we're making sure that we continue to manage through this fiscal crisis as best as humanly possible.
Was this some of that spending that was questionably off the books?
Yeah, you bet it is. You bet it is. Absolutely. That $500 million, we didn't know about it until we had the Debt Transparency Act, right? So the governor had been essentially hiding the actual expenditures that his agencies made from the public. And if we didn't have this monthly reporting, we wouldn't even know about it until next October. Think about that.
Very timely.
Yes.
I wanted to switch gears a little bit. Are involved with this panel involving the Democratic Party, women of the Democratic Party, kind of trying to find a course forward, aftermath of Me Too and issues within the party structure itself. And I know that there were some hearings that were scheduled, those kinds of things. I'm sorry, I haven't caught up on it.
No worries.
But I'm just wondering, where do things stand on that topic?
Sure. So I don't remember if I told you, because when we first talked about it, it was like so early on in the stages, but we actually set up as an independent 501c4.
Because part of the problem early on was who could be on it.
Because of Sherry Bustos, federal laws and blah, blah, blah. So essentially, we wanted to have a firewall between the Democratic Party of Illinois and the work of the panel. And in order to ensure we could do that, we went the 501c4 route and then made it a nonpartisan attempt at addressing the issues of sexual harassment in the political workspace, as well as what can we do as parties, regardless of what party you're in, right, to elevate women within the party structure. And so those are the two issues that the panel from the very beginning was charged with working on. And we've had six listening sessions throughout the entire state of Illinois. We were obviously here in Chicago. We were in Springfield. We were in Edwardsville. We were in Carbondale. We were in Rockford and in Champaign-Urbana. So we did six sessions. They were really well attended. We had Democrats and Republican women come out and share their stories with us and their recommendations for how to improve the issue of, you know, tackling sexual harassment, making sure that women feel safe and supported in their workspace, and knowing that there could be, or what would be a better way of allowing them to report an instance that happens, feeling that they're allegation or their complaint would be taken seriously and dealt with legitimately. And then also the issue of not enough women being in elected office, and how do we break down some of the barriers and the obstacles to entry. And one of the cool things that came out of it was this real passion now for like making Illinois the first state in the country. Rick, you'd never heard this probably till right now. I've said it maybe three times publicly now, but you got to see it in order to make it happen, right? And I really want to make, in my colleagues do as well, Illinois the first state in the country to flip female majority in the legislature. Because let me tell you something, everything that we're talking about, whether it's sexual harassment or how do you elevate women in the parties, et cetera, isn't really going to fundamentally change until we change the power structure that exists today. And when Illinois has 35% of all of its legislature female, I don't think that's a high enough number. We make up over 50% of the population. And while 35 may sound like a good number, it does make us the sixth highest state in terms of women. Did you know that?
I did not.
Yep, we're ranked sixth best, actually. But that has happened in large part organically, because women decided to take on the party structure and eventually make their way there. I mean, I ran against the speaker's candidate twice before I got elected. Right. Carol Ammons ran against the DPI candidate before she got elected. Same with Melinda Bush, who's on our panel as a senator. She took on her party and, you know, kind of forced her way into the system. And so a lot of us got there by working against the party. Once we're there, the parties, both Republican and Democratic parties, I think do a really good job of supporting their female elected officials. But if you can get to 35% organically, imagine where we could be in just a few short years if the parties were to intentionally elevate women every opportunity that they had. So, for example, Christine Rodonio, highest-ranking Republican in the Senate chamber, she resigns, and then her appointed Senate seat automatically goes to a man. Maybe he's a wonderful guy. I don't know. But I have a hard time believing that the party, if they tried, couldn't find a wonderfully qualified and competent female to take her place. And so I'd like to see the parties start to think in a deliberative way in terms of elevating women. And when we make up a majority of the legislature, which nobody should be offended by the way, I mean, every single legislature in the state has a majority male structure. And so it would be nice to try to see what would happen in a state where the majority of those seats are held by women. And I think a lot of things would be fundamentally changed. It would significantly be a game changer.
We'll keep an eye on that. And of course, this is nationally a big year for women candidates.
Well, I don't think we don't have the ability to go 51% right now if every single woman in the state that was running won, but Nevada does. So Nevada is in a position right now, they're at 38% female, and if every single woman in their space that's running for office, Democratic and Republican, won their elections, they would be the first state to go 51. They're not going to do it. It's like impossible that every woman will win that every single seat. But again, it's all happened organically. Illinois, I'm putting it out there. We're going to be the first state to make this happen, and it's super exciting.
That's Democratic State Comptroller Susana Mendoza. Madam Comptroller, thank you so much for joining me this
morning. Thanks for having me.